Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
In August 2021, Layla Borrington contacted emergency services claiming her 3-year-old stepson had fallen and hit his head at a home in Nottingham, England. Tragically, the toddler subsequently died from his injuries. However, medical opinion concluded that it had been no accident, but rather the culmination of a history of abuse inflicted on a defenseless, vulnerable child, whose disability meant he couldn't even communicate the pain and fear he was in. This is what happens when a predator abuses their position of care. This is the killing of Harvey Borrington. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi guys, welcome back to my channel. Thanks for being here. Also, you might note that I sound a little bit on the husky side. That's because I've just been touring with my Serial Killer Next Door tour, which has been really amazing. Just come back from Glasgow and Edinburgh. It was absolutely incredible, but I've got this weird tickly cough and also, I don't know, sound like a gargle with gravel. So apologies for the fact that I may be a few octaves lower today. The case I'm going to cover today is really recent. Most of you won't know about it. I wanted to cover it because safeguarding was a huge part of my career and protection of children forms a huge part of safeguarding. So safeguarding in the UK is all about preventing harm, abuse and neglect. And essentially that was a huge component of my work for a very long time. And children in particular are obviously very vulnerable. And when anybody abuses a child's trust, it's something that really resonates and triggers me. When I heard about this case, it was multifold because the truth is that the little boy that we're going to talk about today had extra needs as well. He deserved to be given the most important types of care from his primary caregivers, acceptance, support, motivation, and an understanding of his uniqueness. And because sadly, this little boy's father separated from his mother and then met somebody else, that's a sliding doors moment that we're essentially going to be talking about, really, because that culminates in what we're going to be discussing today, which is the death of Harvey Borrington, this gorgeous little boy. So let's talk about today's case. We have 3-year-old Harvey Borrington. Now, this is a young child and he's severely autistic. And as part of his autistic experience, he's largely non-verbal. So when you look at the autistic population, those with autism spectrum disorder, 25% of individuals who are classified with autism are minimally verbal. Now, when I say minimally verbal, that means that they speak less on average than 30 words or so. Harvey was diagnosed just after his second birthday, which you can understand. Obviously, his mother is going through the developmental milestones with him and recognizing that his development is maybe not in synchronicity with other children's development, and certainly health visitors, etc., are going to also be noting these issues. So it makes sense that when his language in particular isn't coming along, that alerts a mother and certainly the healthcare professionals that there seems to be potentially something deeper going on. So this diagnosis is obviously going to be helpful. It's going to be helpful regarding parent knowing exactly what's happening. It's also going to mean that he can receive the help and support that he needs to ensure that his progress is something that's followed according to his particular diagnosis. And also, I just think it's reassuring when a parent is aware that firstly, they've done nothing wrong and they're doing nothing wrong. And secondly, that essentially that doesn't change how amazing their child is. Every single human being is infinitely priceless, and our children are all different, and some of them have special needs, but that doesn't discount the absolute gift that they are in our world. So this diagnosis occurs, and one of the things that I'll acknowledge from what I've learned about him is that despite the fact that he has this nonverbal issue, he really still wants to be able to express his thoughts, he wants to be able to express his feelings. And even though he only knows a handful of words as far as expressing them, you know, we've got to acknowledge that we don't know what's going on in a child's brain, in a young adult's brain, in an adult's brain with this particular nonverbal issue, just because somebody isn't expressing themselves in the language that the typical population use doesn't mean that they don't have an understanding, etc. But essentially, he only knows a handful of words that he can use to express. So because of this, he tended to communicate mostly through hand gestures, and he'd use people around him. So he'd take a person's hand and then lead them to whatever he wanted. And he also would have different types of scream. So even though he's not acting in a neurotypical way to get what he wants, his diversity has led to him figuring out strategies to achieve what he needs. And it's really important when we think about neurodiverse brains that we don't imagine that because they're not acting and articulating in the way that a neurotypical brain is working and acting, that they are not bright, that they are not intelligent. They are often super intelligent, and they're finding ways around their disorder to bypass the problems that they're encountering. And certainly this boy's a bright little button. Now, due to his condition, one of the problems that he had was that he was sometimes unable to actually articulate when he was in pain. And I think for any parent who's dealing with a child who at times, as all kids are, because children do things like run into walls, fall off things, and end up with stomach bugs that children pass on to one another, and you absolutely as a parent want to be able to know how to manage it and how to help them. And if a child can't articulate that, that's very challenging for the mum or the dad, because consequently you feel like you're not answering the needs of your child all the time. It can make you feel really guilty, really ashamed that you're not able to decipher these kind of issues. So that's an additional problem that he had, but that also would be translated for his caregivers, because if you're a loving caregiver, all you care about is your child's well-being. Now, he was absolutely a happy, healthy, and really, really well-loved child. This is a little boy who is absolutely adored, and rightfully so. Now, his father, 31-year-old Jonathan Borrington, had separated from his birth mother, Katie Holroyd, when he was around 14 months of age. So he lived with Katie during the week, and then he spent most of his weekends with his father. And his father had met somebody new. That was his stepmother, 22-year-old Layla Borrington, and 3-year-old stepsister. So he had like a stepfamily, as so many people do, as I do in my own family. Very, very common these days. I will have it known, because research is very evidential in this area, that there's no easy feat at creating a really functional stepfamily, particularly if there are multiple children involved that all aren't completely related. Because as soon as you start having stepsisters, half-sisters, etc., it can additionalize the issues emotionally within a family. And that's not because people don't try to be loving parents to children that aren't biologically theirs. Clearly, we see in adoption that there are millions of parents who would die for their children, and they don't need to be blood related to them. However, if you're in a relationship with somebody and you've had a baby with them, and then there is an additional child that you are not physically related to, but by proxy you are because your partner is related to them, there is a strong chance that the way that you will feel about your biological baby is different to the way that you'll feel about your non-biological child. I'm sure that some people usurp this and change that and overcome it. I get that. But I think that a lot of people are very honest, and I've certainly worked with many people and written about many situations where the parent who is not biologically attached finds it more difficult at times with the non-biological child because they have a comparison base, which is, I grew this baby, I birthed this baby, I feel that I have a position of territory and ownership to some degree over this particular child, and they feel a part of who I am. And then there is another child who isn't quite as relevant in that way to me, even though they are very, very important. Doesn't mean that they don't love them, doesn't mean they don't care for them, but it just makes it a little bit more complex. Step families often find it difficult to retain long-term relationships because of the complexities of those issues emotionally. And I'm saying that now because what we're going to cover today, potentially one of the foundations for the problems is that this gorgeous little boy does not...
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't. Right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Biologically belong to Layla. So anyway, this is what we have. This setup where they're living together at the weekends and then he's back home with mum during the week. So as I say, this is how his weeks are split, essentially spending the weekends with his father and stepmother, 22-year-old Layla Borrington, and his 3-year-old stepsister at their house on Main Road in Jacksdale, Nottingham, and then the main weekdays with his mother. Now, whilst Jonathan goes to work, Harvey ends up being therefore left in the sole care of Borrington. And bear in mind, we're talking about a child with additional needs. So because of those additional needs, the reality is you're going to need to know how to manage frustration. You're certainly going to have to try to extend as much empathy and compassion and kindness to the child. And if you are a parent, whether you're a step parent, an adoptive parent, or a biological parent, if you are a child with additional needs, it is your duty to educate yourself around those needs. It is your primary duty to ensure that the level of care is appropriate and that you fully understand their condition. Because by understanding their condition, you can affect change to your parenting to make sure and maintain a really effective relationship between you and the child. And I think that it's very easy to imagine that parents will be able to automatically do this because essentially we're adults and it's what we should be able to do. But we often see in scenarios where there are more complex needs, people becoming highly frustrated, people feeling very angry, and also people taking it personally when a child doesn't act according to how you wish for them to act. Particularly if you've got another child and your belief is that they act accordingly to whatever you want. Because what we have here is a situation where this little boy is walking in at the weekends to a family who are a set-up unit, who have an existing child, who will have a level of order and semblance of how they run their household during the week, and then he's inserting himself, or being inserted in this case, because of the situation of separation between mum and original dad, and therefore he's now having to deal with the way that house works, which is probably going to function very differently from his experience at home. And when you're autistic, that's difficult because one of the things that you really want in your life is a sense of order often. So he's got some additional issues because every weekend he's having his habit to some degree at home broken and he's being placed in a family who are working without a doubt in a different way to how it will work with his mummy. So he needs this extra empathy. He needs his extra kindness, but he's not going to get it. He really isn't. Instead of receiving that love, that compassion, the patience from his carer, it seems he's subjected to sustained abuse. And the worst thing about this, of course, is that this is abuse that he's unable to communicate to others. He's nonverbal. He hasn't got the range of emotional vocabulary at this stage because of his age as well to express what's happening, but he hasn't got the language to do that either. It's incredibly difficult for a child in this situation. How can any child really, in this scenario, express to another caregiver who can protect them what's happening? He can't. He can't even tell his own mother that he didn't want to stay at Borrington's home. And I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that he did not want to stay at Borrington's home. I'm sure that as he was coming to the end of the week and he was getting the feelings that change was coming, that he must have experienced a level of dread. We get to the 7th of August, 2021. This is when he's in Borrington's care and Harvey just collapses at her home. Now, if you have a child, let's all be honest, who collapses at home, what are you gonna do? There's one thing that you are gonna consider in that moment. I don't care how panic-stricken you are, I don't care how scared you are, I don't care how confused you are, there is one thing you're gonna do. You're gonna get your phone, which you're probably gonna have really near you because this is in the world of mobile technology and everybody has their phone with them, and you're gonna press 999. Kids of 3 and 4, they understand that that's what you do in a circumstance of great danger for anybody. If a child collapses, that is horrifying. And all you're gonna think about is, oh my God, what do I need to do? Bear in mind as well, we have the communication issue where Harvey's concerned. So she'll be aware that he can't communicate pain. So if this kid collapses and you can't figure out because of the issue that he's nonverbal and doesn't express when things are going on for him physically, that you need to take action. That's an immediacy requirement. But that doesn't happen. So instead of immediately phoning for an ambulance, which any of you listening would have done, instead she decides that she's gonna film Harvey. This is at 1:56 p.m. Now this kid that she's filming after his collapse, just kind of let that register, he lies on the floor moaning. He's lay on his side, critically injured at this moment. He's on the living room rug and she's filming him. In the video, she also takes Harvey's left arm, she lifts it up and then she just lets it drop loosely to the floor. Again, we've got a child who's clearly limp, a child who's clearly suffering, a child who is clearly struggling. It doesn't take Einstein to know what to do next. And you see, I have a problem with this every single time I cover a case where somebody has waited. Because the people who wait tend to be the individuals struggling. We've all been there. We've been in situations where we've felt really unwell and we've just said to ourselves, it'll be okay. And sometimes it has been, and sometimes it hasn't been. How many of us have ended up at A&E because we waited too long? It's something that humans do on an individual basis, but I guarantee none of you will have watched a loved one collapse and struggle and moan in pain, go limp, and thought, I'll just give it some time, or I'll video this person. Because time is of the essence. When somebody collapses, it can be a scenario where we are talking life and death. We don't take a chance with somebody that we love. We act according to the way that we feel, and the way that we should feel is protective and wanting to prevent any terrible outcome. And she doesn't do that. So at this point, I instantly become suspicious. You have to become suspicious because a normal reaction, particularly when you have your own child biologically, is to take the action required to ensure the protection of the individual that you are caring for when they are a young infant. And Harvey is a young infant. But after she's done this, videoed him a little bit, she then carries on filming him. At this point, he's motionless. Can you imagine where you would be emotionally in that situation? I guarantee you would be climbing the walls in panic and you would be on the phone to the emergency services within seconds, thinking, what the hell has happened? Because the truth is, and this is another reason why I'm instantly suspicious, if you know what's happened, you may have a reluctance to call emergency services. If you know, for example, you've done something wrong, then psychologically you are going to anticipate that if emergency services come, there is a chance, a significant chance, that they may point the finger of blame at you. So therefore, you don't call emergency services because you try to allow yourself time. You try to allow yourself a sense of hope that at the end of the day, this is just a temporary state, this child isn't too badly injured, and they're going to be okay. So you hedge your bets. You take time, you figure out maybe, just give it another 5 minutes, he'll be okay. You don't want people coming because you know exactly what you've done to create this situation. So that's another reason why I'm very suspicious as to why she didn't choose to ring the ambulance immediately. And if it's not bad enough what I'm telling you, it gets worse, because after she's taken this video, she sends the footage to his father, he's out at the cinema at the time, along with the message asking, why does this happen to me? I mean, I think right now we could say answers on a postcard. Yeah, why does it happen to you? Why does this happen to you? I would imagine because you happen to the child. And that's why it happens to you. Just throwing it out there, making a bit of a guess there. She doesn't even make an attempt to rouse Harvey. And I think that that's because, again, she has very little care for this child. She's not really that concerned. And probably in the back of her mind, she's thinking it's all going to be okay. I think potentially if you've done these kind of things to a child before and you've got away with it, then you could imagine that if you just leave it, he's going to come round and things will be fine again and no one's going to know about your horrible abuse. But all she's demonstrating here in this moment of crisis with this little boy who's really seriously unwell now is a complete lack of care and compassion. She then goes and sends another message later to his father, and that says, don't leave the kids with me again. I mean, how narcissistic is that? It's all about me. Don't leave the kids with me again. I don't want to have to look after them. I'm not responsible or accountable for my actions. You're the person who's chosen to leave me by myself with these children. So I'm just letting you know, don't do that again. Can you see how somebody removes accountability and responsibility? Projecting, this is your fault. I should not have been here with this child. And also what I could say is that psychologically there's a level within her where she understands that she's not a safe person to be around children. So that's an acknowledgement. Even though she's not being accountable for her actions, there's an acknowledgement of her lack of compassion, lack of empathy, lack of maternal instinct, and actual lack of safety around children. I also think it demonstrates clearly that she understands she's highly impatient, because you wouldn't say that to the father. You wouldn't say, don't leave the kids with me again. What mothers tend to do is bear the burden of the major childcare responsibilities. So mothers regularly see that as their role. They're not saying, I'm not going to do that again. That's not for me. Because we all know the answer and antidote to that. Don't get pregnant. She then, in the end, contacts emergency services. It's now 2:02 p.m. So the paramedics rush there, of course. This is a little boy who's really unwell, very unresponsive. So the paramedics arrive and they then find Harvey, as it's put in the report, deeply unconscious, unresponsive, and with abnormal body posture. My God, those poor paramedics, can you imagine walking in? This is a little boy. There is nothing more traumatizing or devastating than seeing a child who's seriously unwell. It feels like it goes against nature. It feels like you immediately have this responsibility to help them, because as an adult, when we're well adjusted, we're hardwired to want to make a difference where children are concerned and to protect them at all costs, even at a cost to our own lives. That's what the average adult will do. When you suddenly look and see this child in situ at their home where they're meant to be safe, where it's meant to be their sanctuary, where they're meant to be protected, and they'll lay in a strange posture, deeply unconscious, instantly, that's going to make the paramedics feel this huge level of responsibility. And also, I imagine they have taken those images with them. I can't imagine it wouldn't be stained into their consciousness. Now, Borrington, of course, at this...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This point is thinking of excuses, something you don't do. Just to put it out there, the one thing that makes you look highly suspicious and instantly makes you a suspect is when you are actually offering explanations at a time you should be either near hysterical or numb and detached because you can't manage the situation because you're fully in shock. The last thing you want to hear is a primary caregiver saying, this is what happened. Because essentially they're affording themselves a excuse. They're affording themselves an alibi to some degree. And the paramedics will know that, and the emergency services, police, etc. will know that. So she comes up with this idea. Harvey has basically fallen backwards from a leather chair and banged his head. Now, I don't know about you. I can tell you that I had quite a few bad head bumps when I was a kid. Some of you might think that that's in context with my personality. Who knows? Certainly my children have had loads of head injuries when they were kids because the boys, they climbed things and they fell off things and landed on their head. Now, even though it's terrifying for anybody to watch their child bump on the ground with their head, you can't quite believe that they are able to get up after doing that. The reality is most children do and don't really have that much of an issue. They might get a bump on the head. Sometimes they might have to go and check out at a hospital, but for the most part, kids are pretty resilient and the skull is pretty damn hard. The idea that a child can fall backwards from a leather armchair, bang his head and be this concussed, this unwell, be abnormally positioned, that just is not in context with these kind of injuries. So they immediately realise there is something seriously, seriously, seriously wrong, and they rush him to King's Mill Hospital, which is in Sutton in Ashfield, and then they end up transferring him to Nottingham's Queen's Medical Centre. Obviously, incredibly concerned about what's happened, but also acutely concerned with the type of injuries because these are not in context with what has been described has happened as far as his primary caregiver in that moment explaining and expressing how the injury occurred. So then we have the medical experts. They look at Harvey's injuries and they all but immediately conclude that there's no way that how she's described this played out was in reality how it played out. In fact, they say the injuries to this little boy had, as far as they were concerned, been caused by repeated blows, most likely slaps around the head, and certainly not a one-off fall, as Borrington has claimed. They also said that the fatal blow that had been caused by blunt force trauma and that blunt force trauma had fractured the skull. This is a little boy with extra needs who should have been afforded compassion, patience, love, empathy, and instead we're talking about a blunt force trauma, strong enough that it had fractured the skull. When I think about those kind of injuries, I think about somebody picking a child up and swinging them by their legs into a hard surface, onto a wall, etc. What we're talking about is the necessity for quite a lot of power to affect that kind of impact on the skull. And actually, it was impactful enough that damage had been caused to his brain. So we're talking about catastrophic injuries to this little boy. So the damage to his brain was extensive. So there was bleeding overlying the brain, damage to the brain itself, and also, and this is really integral to the investigation and also so important, they discover older injuries. So historic injuries are found on his body. Now these include a spiral arm fracture, just remember that. It's really important, spiral arm fracture. For those parents out there who've had kids with breaks, you will know that's not a common one to hear. He also had a scrape on his back, he had marks on his face, marks on his ears, and he also had deep scalp bruises. And of course, the problem with deep scalp bruises is that the hair covers the scalp. So even if a child has got bruises to the scalp, often you won't see them. And tragically, that gorgeous little boy, he died 2 days after he was taken to that hospital. He died from really serious head injuries. That was on the 9th of August, 2021. And it was actually a very serious fatal brain bleed that essentially killed him. Now the doctors, they're absolutely immediately suspicious. These injuries are not contextual within childhood, particularly when you line it up with the suggestion that he'd just fallen off the back of a chair. That in itself is certainly not making sense. So they notify the police and the police then begin the investigation. And of course, the only person who was looking after that little boy at the time that he was so catastrophically injured is Borrington. So of course she's going to be the individual who's arrested, and she's soon after this event charged with Harvey's murder and also multiple counts of actual and grievous bodily harm because of all these horrible injuries. So the accusations are that she inflicted 5 attacks on this defenseless little toddler over 4 months, which led up to his eventual death. They say that the final attack, she was suspected of slapping him repeatedly around the head, and that this had caused the fatal brain injury. Now, what's additionally devastating in this case is, of course, that Harvey couldn't actually articulate the abuse he'd suffered. And I cannot imagine how dreadful that is for his mother. She was sending her child that she adored to this home, believing that he'd be having nice weekends with his father and stepmom. And the likelihood is that he was just receiving horrible, repeated abuse. And he would have gone home and wouldn't be able to articulate that and express that. And for his poor mother to have to live with that feeling, to experience, which she will, a guilt because she didn't know, it's so unfair. She will be living with that trauma for the rest of her life. And I'm sure that she cannot comprehend the agony that her child must have endured at the hands of Borrington. Also, one of the reasons that the police believe that Borrington went for this gorgeous little boy is because he couldn't talk about his abuse. Essentially, she used his neurodiversity against him. Because he was nonverbal, he was a perfect victim. She could do what she wanted at her pleasure, and he wouldn't be able to firstly resist because he's a little toddler. He ain't going to be able to match her. He's not going to be able to show her any strength, resist the attacks. He can't defend himself in any way, shape, or form. But on top of this, he can't let people know this is happening to me. So essentially, she knows that she can get away with it. Obviously, she goes too far, and that's why we're telling this story now. But for many months, it seems that she's been able to enjoy harming him. And there is a level of enjoyment to this kind of abuse. And this has led to her getting into a comfortable scenario where she feels that she can do what she wants and nothing consequential is going to happen to her. And for me, on a safeguarding level, that is just so despicable. You've got this little vulnerable kid and she knows that she can do whatever she wants. She's sneaky and abusive and can connect that because this child can't express himself, no one's gonna know. And if she boxes clever and doesn't injure him too badly, she's gonna be able to take out all her frustrations whenever she likes onto him. So his death, the investigators believe, had essentially culminated after this history of abuse. Now, when they posed that to Borrington, of course, she's like, I didn't do any of this. Completely innocent. Can't believe that you're charging me. She said she would never have harmed him in any way at all. And when she has asked about the broken arm, what she actually says is, yeah, okay, he did get a broken arm, it seems, but the reason that he got this broken arm is because he was basically walking up the stairs, he tripped, and she actually ends up grabbing his arm, pulling him up as he trips, and this is essentially how the injury had occurred. So that's her excuse for that one, but like, as I said, remember what I said about spiral break, just so it kind of connects, because we're gonna go through that shortly, and it's important. It's gonna be very illuminating when I describe that. She also says that all the other injuries that they've discovered, yeah, they're all self-inflicted. So he hurt his back by jumping off a stool. Also, this is really upsetting for me because she uses this as an excuse, but this to me evidences the abuse level, because she says that the bruising on his cheeks, that was caused by her pinching them. I kid you not. She literally admits this because she thinks it's a defense. Yeah, she says that when he ate, he used to store food in his cheeks, and because that could have led to him choking, she pinches him enough to cause bruising so that he doesn't choke. I'm sorry, you do what? You pinch a child so he doesn't. Listen, the reason that this makes me super suspicious is when a child has any issues, and some children will have issues that cause concern. If you have a child who stores all their food in their cheeks and you think that that might mean that they overswallow and cause themselves the potential to choke, that's gonna be something you need to be conscious of. And what are you gonna do? You're gonna make damn sure that you provide them with a certain amount of food. You're gonna watch them like a hawk. And then once they finish that amount of food, you'll give them some more. You're not gonna sit there, let them stuff as much in their mouth as possible and then pinch their cheeks to let them know too much. First of all, we've got a non-verbal child here. He's not necessarily understanding why you're injuring him for that context. Secondly, it is far better to, as I said, behaviourally modify the amount of food you're giving that child in that moment in time. For her to feel comfortable saying, oh, I pinch his cheeks so that he doesn't store food in them, that is abusive. It makes no sense whatsoever. Also, the pinch marks on his ears, she says, listen, it's just that he had these repeated ear infections, and so the consequence is he gets upset with that. So because of that, he pinches his ears because he's just frustrated by that. Now, look, I don't doubt that if you're a jury, by the way, and you're being told that somebody pinches their ears because they've got an infection, that that might not resonate with you to some degree. They are horrific when you get a bad ear infection. It can drive you to distraction and you can kind of grab your ears because they're hurting so much. So I do think that the jury would have an issue when they're hearing that particular message because that could be contextual. Of course, personally, I just think, looking at all the other excuses, that she's just had some time to contemplate how she's going to make this sound like a viable reasoning. However, the investigators were absolutely not convinced by these excuses for the injuries, but especially the one that really stood out to them is the broken arm. So remember what I said, a spiral fracture. So a spiral fracture, that occurs because a bone's been broken by a twisting motion. So if you imagine a normal injury, for a break, that's like a green stick injury. So my son, when he was on the monkey bars in a park, he fell off, his hand went under his arm, and essentially that caused a green stick injury, a clean break essentially across his arm. And you could kind of see in the x-rays, it was just a perfect white line, just a little bit further out at each side than the normal bone would be. And that is a classic injury of a break. But a spiral fracture, that's different. So that's when a fracture occurs because the bones...
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cashback and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use and you can get your cashback sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers and Rakuten shares the money with you as cashback. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to...
get your bag!
Two ways to peel for a chance to...
get your bag!
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to...
get your bag!
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Been broken in a twisting motion. And it creates this fracture that wraps around the bone. So the best way to describe it is it resembles a corkscrew as opposed to this clean break. So bear in mind, she's told the investigators it happened when he was climbing the stairs and she just yanked him back to protect him from falling, no doubt. Well, if she did it at such a level that that yank was so powerful that it caused a break in the arm, forget even the fact that it wouldn't be contextual because this is the wrong kind of break for that action, you would imagine that she'd dislocate his shoulder before she actually caused a break to his arm because that's what would take the impact. But this is why they're really suspicious, because that corkscrew break makes no sense whatsoever. And again, another thing that really concerns them is they've got this video. Harvey is literally lay dying on the floor and she's recorded this at 1:56 p.m., right? So that's disturbing. That's not typical of a loving parent at all. But also, they noticed that there's a video on her phone that had been recorded 30 minutes earlier. That's at 1:34 p.m. And in this video, he's actually great. He's alive as well, he's playing with his toys, he's placing items in a dishwasher. We've all seen how our children love to use all the adult machinery in the house. That's why, bit of advice, if you have a child, don't go and buy any of those bright items that tend to mimic things like the actual remote control, because they won't like them. They want the remote control, or they want your actual phone. It's far better to just get old, broken versions of those, which I guarantee will be far more attractive to that baby. So the police believe that the actual fatal assault has occurred in the interim 22 minutes, because of course we've got that further video that's been taken, I suppose, moments after that little boy has suffered that unsurvivable injury. And that one is the one where he's seen crying, he's seen wailing on the floor. And the police ask the question, they pose it to her, you know, why had you filmed that? And she says, I just knew he was not making a noise at first. And then when he started making a noise, I expected him to come around. So that's why I just took it to show his breathing and how he was. Honestly, guys, do you know what that is? That's word salad. It makes no sense. It explains nothing. It's just word salad. It's just words coming out of her mouth that don't actually add any important facts to the reality of what we're talking about. It's just her saying stuff that makes no sense whatsoever and actually doesn't further our understanding of the situation. Because at the end of the day, why would you start filming him, expecting him to come round and to look at his breathing? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. If you're that concerned, you're going to be on the phone. And she goes on to say, yeah, you know, I did it because basically it was in anticipation of being asked to go to A&E by the NHS 111 service. And I plan to show it the doctors. I mean, come on. What is she doing? What is she saying here? This makes absolutely no sense. And again, what blows my mind about this particular individual is she creates a narrative where she somehow tries to place herself as the caring, compassionate parent stroke hero. Just think about some of the things that she's evidenced. She said that the reason that he broke his arm, she was saving him. He was gonna fall downstairs. So yeah, he ended up with a break in his arm, but at the end of the day, it could have been so much worse, couldn't it? If she hadn't been present when he tripped and when he fell, well, it could have been worse than a broken arm, couldn't it? Then we have the pinches to the cheeks. Of course, that's not to do with her being an evil stepmother. No, nothing at all. She's a hero. She's just trying to ensure that the child does not choke to death. So that's the second evidence base of her playing the role of being the person who's actually caring, compassionate and loving to this child, his protector. And then on top of that, we have the scenario where she's videoing him, not because she's catastrophically injured him, not because she's caused a bleed to his brain and he's not going to survive this. No, it's because she just wants to be a diligent little cookie and make sure that A&E staff are aware of the issues that he was dealing with at home. That's why she videoed him, as opposed to just getting on the phone immediately and screaming for help, which every other well-adjusted adult, related or otherwise, would have done. So look at how she is narcissistically acting in this moment. She is placing herself at the center of this as the hero, not the villain in the piece. And she's victim blaming him all the way through. He's clumsy falling up the stairs. He's gonna choke because he stuffs food in his cheeks. He falls off a chair because he's stupid. These are all ways of projecting blame onto him and mitigating blame against her. And that is absolutely offensive. And also, the very fact that she's calculated and concocted this piece of, I've done this to help the actual doctors. Again, she's trying to consistently think of reasonable excuses, which is not what you do in these circumstances, because you are too blindsided by the reality that this child is dead. In fact, the one thing that she doesn't say is, what more could I have done? How could I have been better? He died on my care. Even though I am innocent of these charges, I still feel like I deserve to be punished. Because that's what most normal adults would do. You'd feel horrified, mortified, terrified, and absolutely ridden with guilt and shame that they had died in such despicable ways on your watch. It's as simple as that. And we hear none of that from her. We get to November 2022. This is when the trial commences at Nottingham Crown Court. The prosecution obviously believe they've got a relatively strong case, and they accused Borrington of twisting and turning her account to suit the evidence. I think that she's very manipulative, and I think she's very effective at doing that. Like I said, when she's accused of pinching his cheek, she says that she was protecting him because of the food. When we see the spiral break, she says that she was protecting him from falling down the stairs. So she's given this very powerful evidence, and then she inserts an excuse that she feels is going to be compelling enough for the jury to find her not guilty of actually carrying out the assaults that we're looking at today. They also say, as the prosecution, that this was not a one-off attempt, that she'd been injuring this little boy for months leading up to his death, and ultimately on that final occasion that had led to the infliction of the fatal brain injury. Also, they push forward that narrative that the reason that she did this was because she liked the fact she wasn't going to be found out. He was basically that ideal victim. He couldn't confide in anyone, he couldn't talk to anyone, he couldn't let them know that he was being abused by her, and that gave her the perfect opportunity. There was a secrecy there, not because he wanted to keep it secret, because he didn't have the means to actually express it. And they also say, listen, you're saying you're innocent. You're saying that all of the things that we're talking about can be put down to these excuses that you're making, and also the projection onto Harvey that he was the problem, he's causing the injuries. And they actually say, if that's true, if it's just that he's having these injuries because he's causing them, how come the injuries only began when you started looking after him? I mean, correlation is as simple as that. She starts looking after him, and soon after that, he starts getting badly injured. That in itself is damning as far as I'm concerned. Now, Borrington, of course, has an answer for that. She says it was because he was getting older. He was becoming more and more mobile, and also he was becoming clumsy. Can you imagine? What is this woman like? She has an answer for everything, an excuse for everything. It's not happening anywhere else. You know, when this little kid's at home with his mother, he's fine. When he's with his dad, he's not getting horrendously injured. But, you know, when Borrington's there, apparently all these injuries occur because this kid's just clumsy. He's just getting older. And what do perpetrators do? Perpetrators blame their victims. It's as simple as that. How can they turn the narrative in their gain and make the actual victim who's been harmed, in this case killed, seem like the offending party, the problematic party? But like I said, that makes no sense because it's not happening anywhere else. And I can kind of imagine the frustration of the investigators and the prosecution when they're dealing with this woman who just takes absolutely no accountability whatsoever. Now, in her defense, Borrington just says, listen, this was a tragic accident. He fell backwards off the chair. But then she also says that she didn't actually witness that happening. Yeah, so she has that explanation for everything going on, even down to the fact that she tells them that he died because of doing this, when actually she says that she didn't have the evidence for doing that. It was just what she imagined could have happened, which means that she's a liar. She told them that he fell off that chair. She was comfortable doing that. It's only when they kind of pose the question, how could she possibly have known that that had occurred, that she denies it. So we know at this point she's happy to make things up. And that's damning as far as I'm concerned. But she's just basically a game with that excuse, says, oh, it's the only thing that could have happened. Simple as that. They then ask, well, why didn't you get him any treatment for the previous injuries that he had, including the broken arm? And Borrington said that Harvey didn't communicate when he was in pain. That is true. So she said that that meant that some of the injuries that he experienced went unnoticed, which is just horrific because, again, she's using a truth against this victim. She's kind of wrapping it up in a way where she can defend herself, as opposed to honestly stating, well, I actually knew that he was never going to be able to communicate this pain, which meant that I had free license and rein to harm him however I wanted. And actually, in the days after that little boy died, she even told a friend he broke his arm and didn't fucking cry. Can you believe that? He broke his arm and didn't fucking cry. Did he break his arm really, though? I mean, I'm just going to put it out there. I don't believe a word coming out of this woman's mouth. Also, when she's asked about that damning video, because clearly she had that, and she said that she was going to be able to present that to the doctors, etc. But she didn't show the ambulance crew, and she said, oh, well, there was no point then. There was no point, because apparently Harvey had been in the same condition when they arrived as he was on the video. But that then denies the reality of taking the video and what you said to the investigators. Because you specifically said to the investigators that you recorded it because you wanted the doctors to be able to see it. So therefore, why wouldn't you have taken that video and shown the doctors? So again, she's creating this narrative, but it falls apart on deeper inspection. So yeah, again, the excuse she's got here is that she just let them get on with treating him. Because again, she's the hero. She's prioritizing his needs and not her needs. But when it comes down to the pediatrician, who's a consultant pediatrician who looks at this and looked at those fatal injuries that that little boy had experienced, he said there's absolutely no way whatsoever this was an accident. This was a result of blunt force trauma. And he goes on to say that the head and eye injuries that Harvey suffered, that they had absolutely been purposely inflicted. She stated, Harvey died from traumatic head injuries. No naturally occurring medical condition explains the presence or severity of the injuries that led to Harvey's death. The account provided by his caregiver does not explain the extent of his injuries. In my opinion, the cause of Harvey's head injuries were inflicted injuries by means of direct impact trauma, with or without additional abusive shaking injury. So within that, they're not even denying that there's a possibility that he was also shaken, which we know can be absolutely catastrophic for young children. But it's damning. That consultant is saying, no way, Jose, this didn't happen as a result of an accident. So clearly the experts from the police themselves, right through to the doctors who dealt with this gorgeous little boy's death, they're all in agreement. There is no way this is accidental. So the trial, it lasts several months. And then we actually get to the verdict. Borrington's found not guilty of murder. Yeah. So in spite of what I've told you so far, the jury do not feel comfortable finding her guilty of murder. I'm imagining that the defense put up some substantial arguments. And you have to remember that all we need is for reasonable doubt to exist. So it takes more than 24 hours of deliberation for the jury to come to that conclusion. And they say that the reason that they came to that conclusion is because she hadn't actually intended to kill Harvey or even to cause him serious harm. I don't get it. Genuinely.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I can only express that I feel the way that she looked might have played a part in this. I don't think she looks like what people imagine a typical murderer looks like. And I believe that that kind of bias can have a huge impact on the way that juries deliberate. But essentially, what comes across is that they don't feel that that day she intended to kill him. But the harm that I've described so far is serious. So I don't compute or align myself with the messaging that they heard. Also, and again, this is frustrating, they clear her of the three charges of assault occasioning actual bodily harm. I will tell you again that there is a likelihood that the defense were basically saying, listen, you have no actual evidence that she was the person who caused those injuries. And again, only has to be reasonable doubt, and they have to find that person not guilty of that particular offense. But she was, fortunately, found guilty of the alternative charge of manslaughter. So the jury didn't believe her account that Harvey had fell off the couch and hit his head. And therefore, they concluded that he'd been killed unlawfully. She was also, on top of this, fortunately, convicted of inflicting GBH for previously breaking Harvey's arm. So she had admitted, of course, pulling his arm back. They obviously didn't believe that the injury was a spiral break. That was evidence enough for them to feel that that was GBH. And also she was found guilty of assault occasioning actually bodily harm for an incident in which she squeezed his cheeks, because again, she admitted that. So even though they couldn't find her guilty for all of the suspected abuse, they found her guilty for all of those. Apparently she wiped tears away as the verdicts were announced, and I imagine that those tears were flowing for herself. I think they were flowing for herself. I do not think she was crying for the little boy whose life is over, or for the mother of the little boy who has to wake up every single day wondering what has happened to her life. I imagine she was crying for herself. So on the 16th of March 2023, that's literally just about 2 weeks ago, I'm filming this at the end of March 2023, been following this case from the get-go, Borrington is sentenced. But before the sentencing occurs, Harvey's mother, Katie, read her victim impact statement, and she described her son as the most loving little boy anyone could have wished for. She also described the horrific impact that his death had had on his grandparents, particularly his granddad, because his granddad saw himself as the protector of the family, and because he failed in his mind, of course, he'd not failed at all. But in his mind, because he hadn't been able to protect that little boy, he felt that purpose had been lost. He'd actually withdrawn from life, which is testament to how much this little gorgeous boy was loved. And you see, this is the ripple effect of these kind of crimes. You look at the trauma that will be so generational in this case, you know, grandparents, parent, any other subsequent children, they'll all be affected by this loss without a doubt. It's harrowing to imagine that this poor woman, the mother who adored this son, and her own parents are just struggling on a day-to-day basis. And in fact, her father feels like he's failed. I can't imagine that kind of cross to bear. It is just awful. But also that just shows the juxtaposition between the killer and the protector. You know, you've got this grandfather, mother, grandmother, all feeling absolute trauma, sorrow, guilt even. Not that they deserve it, because they didn't protect this child. And yet you have the perpetrator just thinking about their own life, just having regards for their own protection, for their own freedom. She was crying for herself, not for this little child. And Harvey's mother also said that she condemned her son's killer because she hadn't admitted to what she'd done. And because she hadn't admitted to what she'd done from the outset, that meant that they had to go through the ordeal of a trial. So can you imagine being a member of that family? You've lost your absolutely blessed child, grandchild, that you adored. And now, because the perpetrator will not take responsibility for what they've done, will not admit causing those injuries, you have to sit through a trial. And you have to do that because you want your child, in whatever dimension they're in, to understand that you were there for them in life and in death. You want to be there. You want to be their voice. But that means you've got to see the videos, you've got to see the injuries, you've got to hear the experts describing the agonizing death. You have to have that in your head for the rest of your life. And the perpetrator in this case was quite happy to allow those members of that family to endure that. And as Harvey's mother said, that was purely because she wanted to protect herself. She stated, "To this day, I can't bear to think of him lying on that floor with him dying and her filming him, delaying getting medical attention for him. My beautiful boy, he couldn't talk. He couldn't articulate the suffering he had to endure. He couldn't tell me he didn't want to go." She has to live with that every day. And that's what a loving parent feels. The horror, the trauma, the guilt, the desire to protect when they no longer can protect. He had a beautiful family. Unfortunately, this malevolent individual found a way in. And because of that, Harvey's no longer alive. Katie also relayed a particular cherished memory of Harvey to the court. It was about a trip to Matlock. It's a lovely area in the UK. They'd had this really long walk on the cliffs, and she'd carried Harvey most of the way. They sat and had a picnic. They watched the boats. He absolutely loved them. Apparently he didn't want to leave. And he just stood smiling when he was looking at them. Later on that day, he'd had chocolate ice cream and they'd ended the day playing in the park. Such a precious memory. And I think for most of us parents, we'll relate to that. You know, people put huge amounts of money into events, birthday parties, Christmases, buying amazing presents. But actually, if we're really honest, often the memories that have the most meaning, they're memories that occur in the most simplest of moments. A walk on the cliffs, chocolate ice cream in the park, just a perfect presence of being with our children. It really, really resonates with me, and I'm sure it resonates with so many of you, and I think it's a beautiful memory to share. When it came down to the actual sentencing, 23-year-old Borrington got 15 years in prison. She'll have to serve 2/3 of that sentence before she is eventually released on license. So even though she didn't actually get found guilty of murder, which I do feel frustrated by, but I have sympathy and empathy with the jury, and certainly I did not hear the case in court, so I did not hear the defence. But I will say that still 15 years is a relatively strong sentence. So in passing sentence, the judge actually detailed aggravating factors of the case. So first of all, it's obvious that Harvey was incredibly vulnerable, so he should have got extra care and attention. You know, bear in mind his age, bear in mind his disability. So there's been this severe breach of trust. That's an absolute aggravation factor. And Borrington's meant to be caring for him. She failed to get immediate help following the fatal assault. The judge actually referred to this as a shocking lack of care and concern. And also his death had followed a history of violence at her hands. So the judge stated that Harvey's death must have been a sustained violent assault. And that's why the serious sentence was passed, because you can see, even though apparently it wasn't premeditated and she hadn't intended to kill him, the actual level of assault was so serious that it warranted this sentence. And the jury must have had to view some pretty horrific things, because due to that distressing nature of the evidence during the trial, the judge actually excused the jurors from any further jury service for 10 years. So it must have been astonishingly nasty, the information that they heard and the content that they had to look at. Now, this is gonna blindside some of you. For others, you may understand it. I am struggling to understand this. Because despite being convicted of causing Harvey's death, his father still plans to marry Borrington. Genuinely. That's right. He still plans to marry her. The woman who's been found guilty of his child's death. Now, they do already have a child together, and they actually got engaged 2 months before the killing. But I don't know about you. I just feel that no matter how you feel about a partner, if they are responsible for the death of your child, I don't really think marrying them is a good idea. Now, I appreciate that that will be because he doesn't believe that she's capable of killing. I believe that he will have a bias because of the experience that he'll have seen with his own child that he's had with her. Because people often assume that somebody could never be a nasty person to one child and a nice person to another, that they'd just be nasty per se. That's not true. In abuse cases, we see it consistently. I mean consistently. There may be one child in the family who is horrifically targeted and terribly abused, and the other kids think they've got great parents. So I think that he is buying into a bias that he has seen the way that she acts with their child, and therefore he will not have that she is an individual capable of carrying out this. But I can't wrap my head around it. I really can't. Also, he's been a really good partner, really good supporter. So since her incarceration, he's visited her regularly at Derbyshire's HMP Foston Hall. And that prison, it's actually a women's prison that's been recently described as the most violent in England. It's not going to be comparable to male prisons where violence is concerned, but certainly that's not a great place to go. And I don't feel sorry for her. I'm not going to pretend I do. So the pair still plans to get married. Yep, they still wish to get married. And again, I cannot comprehend or compute how you can choose an alliance emotionally with a partner responsible for killing your child. unless you believe that the court has got it completely wrong. And that would make sense if the court didn't have absolutely compelling solid evidence. It's as simple as that. This woman abused and killed your child. Why are you validating her? Why are you marrying her? Why aren't you doing the maths and realizing that you're not a terrible human being for falling in love with a monster? It happens. They're very good at masking. I'm sure that her entire family, or at least most of it, also believe that she's innocent, because it's far easier than thinking that this person had that potential. And as I've just mentioned, actually, some of her family members do believe Borrington's account. They do believe that Harvey's death was accidental. And again, I get it. You don't want to see that a member of your family has this kind of potential, particularly if you've not necessarily seen it before, but she was only 23. Lots of people take years to show their true colors. You're doing absolutely no good enabling her to feel that these kind of actions can be excused or denied or avoided, because all you do is exacerbate and amplify potential narcissism within these individuals. She needs to take accountability. She needs to take responsibility. Harvey mattered. His life mattered. And even though it's reprehensible what she did, at least if she was able to say, I lost it, I was a terrible human being in that moment, I shouldn't have done any of the things that I did, I realized I took my frustrations out on this child, I was struggling. Even though we could never have empathy and sympathy with her actions, we could have empathy with her poor coping mechanisms. It would not excuse it, but we could understand it to some degree, and we could hopefully, when the system works with her, affect change.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Because of her willingness to acknowledge it. Now, studies, they've actually found that children with disabilities are 3 times more likely to be abused than those without disabilities. That's just beyond harrowing, isn't it? Now, I know stress, frustration, they tend to exacerbate things like violent intent. So if you are a parent and you have this kind of fracture within you where you are more violent than the average person, and then you have a disabled child, then there is a consequence of feeling stressed and frustrated, and that can result in a temperament being frayed and you acting in a way that is completely despicable by being violent. But 3 times more likely to be abused is a horrific, damning statistic for our society. When you think about it, Harvey's autism meant he couldn't express pain he was suffering or fear that he was in. And that is something that his killer took full advantage of. Make no bones about that. That's exactly what she did. It's how she got away with it so long. And it's how eventually she went too far. Because that's what happened. She enjoyed inflicting pain on this child. She enjoyed taking out her frustrations on him. And eventually, she just went that bit too far. Because if she hadn't, I have no doubt that that little boy would still be living in fear every weekend he had to go there. I mean, I wish he was to some degree, because hopefully over time his mother would have been able to realise, but essentially he never even got that chance. Because like I said, she couldn't control herself at the end point, and ultimately that's why he lost his life. I still can't quite compute at all why her partner is gonna marry her in spite of the fact that literally she stole his son's life. But hey, no accounting for taste, eh? No accounting for taste. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then, be safe.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.